This is Community Transformed with Father Thomas Dubé.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Father Thomas Dubé, and we are going to take up this week, of course, where we left off last week, in discussing Community Transformed. Vision of interhuman relationships, and especially the close ones we have in family and other like institutions, a vision that vastly transforms and goes beyond our human expectations, even embracing what's good in those human expectations. I want to share two ideas before we get into the development of the first aspect of gospel community. Last week we were preparing and clarifying terms and such like. This week we're going to get into the first area, and just shortly, in a few minutes. Two things I'd like to mention, though, that follow from what we said last week. Remember, we finished by identifying what genuine love is. I love a person when I will good things for that person and do good things to and for that person, even if I get nothing in return, which requires a considerable degree of holiness, even to love a person, and that's a willed matter. It's not just feelings, good as feelings might be. So the first little thing I'd like to share with you is a remark of a psychologist who has an arresting statement. When I first saw it, I was very surprised. He may have been touched, or she, I don't remember if it was a man or a woman, doesn't really matter for our purpose. This person, speaking of love, said this, and I quote, "A capacity for genuine love between the sexes is rare. Not only the real thing is rare, a capacity for it is rare." That sounds very much to me as though it's been touched by the gospel, because most people certainly don't entertain that idea. They think that it's very easy. And that brings me to to love another person. Actually, it is very demanding to love another person. Remember the definition: to will good things and to carry them out toward another, even if you get nothing in return from that person. All right. The second little thing I should like to share with you, defining love that way, I am quite convinced there is no such thing as love at first sight. What there is at first sight, undoubtedly, is strong attraction. There are many beautiful people, and I don't refer only to physical beauty, but that is a type of beauty, and it's good. But I'm referring to person beauty, sparkling personality, great talents, and a humility in using them, and so on. There is a lot of personal beauty, and surely we're attracted to this. Most people are, normal people are, at first sight. Just meet the person for a little while, and you're much attracted. That happens. But the gospel definition requires a lot of purification, as we noted last week. Now, I have an interesting little tidbit here. Gallup poll recently asked the question of, I think it was about, yes, a little over 1,000 adults, and asked the question, do you believe in love at first sight? From the group, age group 18 to 29, 60% said yes. And as the ages go on, the percentage becomes a little bit smaller. 30 to 49, 56% believe in it. 50 to 64, 45% believe in it. Apparently they're learning something as they go on in life. And 65 and older, 41 believe in love at first sight. It, of course, depends on how you define love. In all our series, we're going by the gospel definition, a self-giving to another, even when little or nothing is received in return. Now, we are ready then to go on into our first area of the series. There are four main areas. The first one I'm going to call shared vision, and I'm going to explain that shortly and clearly. Nobody else would put that in their list. They would say it's a dreamy ideal, it's a great thing if you had it, but it's not possible, and therefore they don't even put it in their concept of community. That's our first area. The second area is going to be, I'm going to call it, healing communion. We are all of us wounded. I am wounded, you are wounded. Even this ideal, beautiful person that you love, supposing there is a good love in a marriage, for example, or in a convent, the sisters really love each other, or a monastery, The second one, the healing communion, reflects the fact that even this very attractive person is wounded, perhaps not in nearly as much as another person who is unattractive, quite surely not as wounded, but nonetheless, we're all wounded. And therefore, a healthy community heals the wounds, doesn't deepen them, aggravate them, pick at them. It heals the wounds, and so that both people, in a marriage, for example, become more beautiful as the years go by, spiritually, intellectually, personality-wise, even if physically that beauty diminishes. The third area we're going to consider, whether we'll get to it in this whole series or not, I don't know. I prefer, by the way, to be pretty thorough about each thing I talk about as much as possible, rather than cover a lot of areas superficially. We need on these basic realities to be thorough as much as possible. Anyhow, the third area in a full picture of gospel community, transfigured community, the third area, caring and shown warmth. That develops in a lot of different ways, much of which would certainly be agreed with by psychologists. They would agree with it for sure, you see. But we're going way beyond that, the gospel picture of warmth. For example, I'll give you a fast little clue. When the prodigal son comes back after wasting his father's fortune, half of the fortune, on prostitutes, when he returns, he comes to his senses. The father runs to him. It's in Luke 15. Runs to the boy, young man, hugs him and kisses him tenderly. Shown warmth. And there's a lot like that in the gospel. And that's supposed to be part of any convent, any marriage, any monastery, any rectory, and indeed these extended communities even we spoke about in a nursing home. The members should show warmth and a real caring for others. The fourth area, again, isn't even envisioned on the merely human level of psychology. Community in the gospel is a favored place for promoting a deep prayer life, meditative prayer and contemplative prayer. And it's a favored place that this will happen. And actually, this fourth area explains a large part of how the other three areas are transformed. It's in a deep, profound communion with the Lord God. Then you're going to have shared vision and all these other things, shown warmth and the rest of it. Now, those are the areas that can make up the whole concept of gospel community. We take up now the first area, shared vision. And I want to introduce that, first of all. There are loads of conflicts in marriage. There are conflicts sometimes in the convent. They practically never get violent or lay hands on anybody, but they're conflicts. They're human too. Nuns are, monks are, priests are. Everybody is human. But the conflicts that occur in primary communities, marriage included, of course, are considerable. And I want to suggest here the main reasons for conflicts. I don't mean this particular issue or that particular thing that one of these fights is about, that they say, oh yes, another figure, by the way, I just pops into my mind. It was recently said that the average couple has a fight on average once a month. Well, ideal couples don't have any fights. They have disagreements, of course, but they're amiable and they're discussed and each one listens to the other and they're pliable. When no principle is involved, they gladly give in to the other. And there's no fight about it at all. Anyhow, all psychologists who study marriage agree there's a lot of fighting. And we considered some of that last week. I'm glad we're finished with that. I prefer not to talk about it even. But it has to be faced. Now, I want to suggest three main reasons, aside from the particular issue in a given battle. Three main reasons why there are so many disruptions and unhappiness and reasons for divorce and marriage. The first one is basic, I'm talking about, basic reasons. Egocentrism is the first reason, basically, for divorce. Egocentrism literally means, of course, I-ism. I am the center, and I'm the more important one in this convent or this rectory or this marriage. and you just do what I say, and then we'll be at more or less peace, until you do something I don't like, you see. It's an egocentrism, and that's the basic, one of the three basic problems for conflict in communities. The second one is a word that some of you probably have not heard. Others of you may have. Illuminism. Now, I have to explain that. Literally, for those who may not be acquainted with the term, it comes from the Latin word lumen, which it means light. And illuminism is an aberration, centuries-old aberration, whereby a person is convinced that he has insight into reality that others do not have. He's just convinced of it. And no argument against his position, no evidence, even pleasantly presented, will change this person's mind, the illuminist. He is quite convinced he has a favored pipeline to God. That's one type of illuminism. The other type is, the pipeline is namely not a pipeline to God, it's my own superior intelligence. You see, I know better than you know. And I know better, some will even say, than the Pope knows. And he's been commissioned by the Lord himself to teach in the Lord's name. He who hears you, hears me. He who rejects you, rejects me. He and his brother bishops in union with him. I know better than all of them too. Illuminism is a grave aberration. Let me tell you a little story to get it concrete, what an illuminist also is like. I remember I was coming into home base in Washington after a road trip, and there's a metro system, which is a very good system, by the way, and I got on at the airport stop and was going to a stop near home base, and as I got onto this car in the subway train, of course it's above ground too, a good part of the way, anyway, a young man with his son, a young boy, must have been his son, and he came over, and he wanted to talk with me about religion. And I forget exactly what it was we spoke about, doesn't really matter. And so we had a pleasant talk. But I soon found out that this man pays no attention to evidence. So he said something, and it was all pleasant. He was pleasant, and I was pleasant. And he said something that just not so. And so I mentioned reasons why that is really not so. I can't accept that. And he went on with his view, and he didn't even bother to address what I said. It was as though I had not said anything. He was convinced that he's right. And evidence against his position had no influence on him. That's illuminism. And there are people like that. And if you have any doubts about there being many, you might read Ronald Knox's book on enthusiasm. That's the name of the book. People get enthusiastic about things, and some, often they are illuminists. They're enthusiastic, but they have no rational basis for what they're saying. And they offer no evidence for it. It's a 600-page book that details human history for the last 2,000 years. If you have any doubts about how common illuminism is. Now, it's not always real drastic, such as I'm describing, but if that occurs, I'm not exaggerating, but there are other types of illuminism that people may not notice, where I have to be right. And if you disagree with me, you don't have to offer any reasons, because I won't accept them, you see. I'm still right, and this can happen between married couples easily. It can happen among priests, among religious. It can happen anywhere, unless a person is deeply converted. That's the second basic cause for conflict in primary communities, marriage being one of them. Okay, now the third reason for conflict in community is what we take up right now, a lack of shared vision, or as Luke calls it, one mind. And this is what we're going to explain deep in detail. And first, I want to talk about John 17:23 once again. Since we dealt with it last week, I won't even read it this week. I'll just recall it to your mind. Remember, the Lord said, with me in you, and you in me, indwelling mystery and the inner Trinitarian life, may, Father, these people be completely one. I want to work on that adverb, completely one. It is not enough in a primary community that we are one in the sense that we live under the same roof, we're civil toward one another, we reasonably do things that we ought to do, but we have profound disagreements. That is not yet gospel community. It has some good elements in it, but it's not yet the gospel, because complete unity means, most of all, a unity in our mind and our heart, a unity that is not enforced, it's not imposed, but it's there. Now, how that's going to come about, that we will talk about, but that's the third reason, a lack of this that causes so many conflicts in community. And the Lord, of course, rules it out. I don't know, by the way, any other worldview, there may be, any other, but I don't know of it, I've never heard of it, but divine revelation, the Old Testament and the New Testament, and especially the New Testament, any other vision of human relationships that calls for a one mind, and especially the Lord does, and St. Paul, as we shall see. Now, that brings us then to the second text I want to share with you about shared vision. It is in the very beginning of first letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians. After the introduction, there is a section that goes on for three chapters, mentioned also in the fourth. And in my little Jerusalem Bible here, the main area of captioning, divisions and scandals. It was a divided community. And then the secondary headline, caption, factions in the Corinthian church. Then the little paragraph caption, dissensions among the faithful. Notice after Paul introduces the letter and greets them and all the rest, this is on his mind so much, it's the first item of business. They don't have a shared vision about basic things. And Paul is deeply bothered because it's not the Lord's idea of a community. And here's what he says in verse 10. All the same, I do appeal to you, brothers and sisters, for the sake of our Lord Jesus Christ, to make up the differences between you, and instead of disagreeing among yourselves, to be united again in your belief and practice. If I remember correctly, the original Greek is even stronger. Be in perfect agreement in what you hold and how you live. Now, many people would have red flags going up on hearing this. Oh, we have to be all identified and no differences among... No, he's not saying that. I'm going to explain what he's saying shortly. I won't dilute it, but it's not to be exaggerated either. And what I want to notice with you here is notice how Paul is simply spelling out what the Lord prayed for to the Father at the Last Supper. May they be, the Lord said, completely one. And Paul is saying that means an agreement in mind and in heart. Or as Luke tells us in the Acts of the Apostles, the faithful in this ideal beginning gospel community were of one heart and one mind. That is a biblical basis, and we'll be tracing out the meaning of that as we go along. Now, I want to sharpen concepts here so that we will really know what exactly it is that we have in mind. What is vision here in the expression shared vision? Vision is an intellectual seeing. He's not talking mainly about sense vision, taking that for granted. A vision here, a shared vision, means intellectually in our minds about basic things we have one mind about them. We have the truth together. And truth, you notice, is being in touch with reality. If I think that, say, suppose somebody very dear to me, is I know, not only think, but I know that this person is in, say, Beijing. And I have a chance to go to Beijing. I haven't seen this individual for years on end. Somebody somehow provides me transportation. But I think that Beijing is next to Tokyo. I'm in error, which means I'm out of touch with where my beloved person is. So to be in error is really bad news. You're out of touch with reality. And that's why the gospel, by the way, consistently, and not only consistently, always is insisting on truth. It puts us in touch with reality. Now, shared vision means that two people are in touch about the one same reality. And I'm in touch with my beloved friend spatially, physically, when I find out where Beijing really is, and I go there, not to Tokyo. So that this one-mindedness is very important to keep people close together, because together they're in touch with one reality. You already see how extremely important it is. So that this is very much part of what the New Testament has in mind when it speaks of this one mind. It's being in touch with the Lord, everything He has revealed, with our state in life, what is marriage really, what is priesthood, in touch with it, what are the elements that make it up, what are the conditions for it to flourish, and what are the obligations in it. All of that is being in touch. And of course, obviously it appears immediately that married people need to be in touch with these realities, or they've got a big split already in their relationship, which is most of all, it's a bodily relationship, of course, in marriage, but it has to be in mind and heart. Anybody who thinks a bit about it knows that very well. Now, the second kind of thing about shared vision, I'm clarifying concepts now so that we think accurately and on the same wavelength as we discuss shared vision. It will take us at least two or three, maybe four of our segments for a few weeks now just to do this one thing somewhat thoroughly. We come in clarifying concepts next to the levels of shared vision. We don't demand, and the gospel doesn't demand, that we are in agreement about every fine detail of human life. Whether you're going to paint your living room, for example, your parlor room, or whether it's going to be this color or that, of course, you're most likely going to have difference of opinion. You don't have to have a shared vision about that, about those practicalities. Now, there are two basic levels of shared vision. The first one is principles, basics of human life. For example, the illustrations I gave you a little while ago, for married people, all of us really, we have to have a shared vision about God, about the purpose of life. What in the world are we doing on this planet? We're all going to die, and very soon, even if you live to 90 years old, it's not long. Next to eternity, the longest life is just a flick. We have to have a shared vision about purpose of life, the raising of children for married people. They have to have shared vision about that. What marriage is all about, they have to have a shared vision about that. What real love is about, what the church is, and so on, about these real basics. Now, that's the fundamental level that the gospel is mostly envisioning when it calls for shared vision. It's the level we're talking about most of the time. Now, there's another level, not as deep, about practicalities. And here, it's nice when you do have one mind about them, especially something like finances in marriage. It's not the deepest thing about marriage. It's not that first level. But it's nice if husband and wife can agree about finances. It's one of the chief causes of conflict in marriage, so the experts say. The color scheme in the house or the walls, as I just said a minute ago, that's a practicality where we don't have to have a shared vision. If there's disagreement, it's amiably, lovingly worked out, mildly, gently, and with a willingness to sacrifice. If you really love the other, you want what the other one wants, even if you don't prefer it. Where to place the vacuum cleaner? Pardon me, not to place it. Well, even that you might have a shared vision about where to keep it in the house, but especially when to replace it. You don't have to have a shared vision. We should get it changed now and get a new one, or we can go another year with this one. You don't have to have a shared vision, but you work that out amiably. Now, the fourth kind of thing, clarifying terms still, I want to say what shared vision is not, because if I don't present these few exclusions of what we're not talking about, I'm going to be misunderstood for the next 3-4 weeks. Or at least 3, if not 4. Shared vision, as we're envisioning it, Luke's term, one mind, does not mean, first of all, a dictatorial imposing from on high, or a conformed, forced conformism. That is not shared vision. If it's forced, it's not a free vision. We're talking about freedom here, and supposing freedom. Secondly, shared vision is not a fine rigidity in details. This is one of the reasons for squabbles in community. Some person is trying to be rigid in details that really don't matter that much. and to force others to agree. Thirdly, shared vision is not a lockstep conformism. That's a dictatorial sort of thing in societies, certainly in some national governments, and communism and Nazism and so on. It can be a kind of lockstep conformism in an office and so on. Might possibly be in a family, but it's not that. Fourthly, it is not an infringement on freedom. It's not an infringement on human thought, on creative originality. Imposing again there is not what we're talking about, because we're supposed to be creative and we're supposed to be free in our thoughts. We're supposed to be lack of undue imposing of rules and regulations where they're not really needed. So if you have a musician, the person should be free to be creative in music, and or a theologian or a philosopher, creative, but keeping within the bounds of reality, in touch with truth. And the fifth thing I should like to say about shared vision, it is not humanly possible. It can't be had, and I think, by ourselves alone. That's another reason why our community transfigured is way beyond a merely natural community and its unity. Way beyond that. It can't be for us, so when it happens, it's because God gives it and we are open to receive it. We take up at this point next week. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Community Transformed with Father Thomas Dubé on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.